This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Roughly how many submissions did you receive, and will those all go on to partake in the screening, or is there some sort of selection process?
There is a process. It is a competition. It's free to enter. The Pacific Northwest Regionals this year received over 100 entries. I just got back last month from flying out to Ohio to host the Midwest Regionals, and then I'll be flying down to Australia to host the Australian Regionals in October. So for the Pacific Northwest competition, we are just now in the process of jurying those films, and we screen the top 45 films, 15 original films each night over the three-night festival.
What is taken into account in the jurying of the films, not only at this stage, but also in the regional finals?
We jury them on four different criteria: cinematography, story, editing, and acting. So the jury process locally in each regional has individuals, leaders in the arts and civic-minded individuals and politicians that are invited to score the films. And the scoring is on a scale from 1 to 25, 100 being the perfect score. From that, we are able to determine the top 45 films for the screening at the festival. But also at that time, we were able to determine the top 10 films. Then the scores are wiped clean for the top 10 films, and those are sent to our celebrity jurors, which are big-name people in Hollywood, that then rescore the films to determine the first, second, and third place films.
And what are the filmmakers competing for?
The competition has several prizes. You can win a first prize of $1,000, or a second prize of $500, or a third place prize of $250. But wait, there's more. A lot of our celebrity jurors add experiential-based prizes. So, for example, the Oregonian gives out a prize for best story. The Portland Rose Festival folks give out a prize for best editing. The producers of the television show Grimm are giving out a prize this year for best cinematography. And, for example, the winner of the Grimm Prize gets to go on set with the director for a full day to shadow the director and watch the actual filming of an episode.
Oh, nice.
The winner of the Rose Festival Prize gets to work with the Rose Festival's creative team and create a video commercial for the Rose Festival. Uh-huh. Portland Center Stage is giving away a prize for best acting, and the winner of that prize gets to attend at no cost one of their summer intensive camps. So it's just phenomenal the support that we get from people that discover this, and when I ask for help, for them it's pretty much an easy way to give. It's exciting for us to get participation from actual working professionals in the industry. The kids that submit films get their films seen by these professionals. So it's just a wonderful win all the way around.
As to the nature of your submissions, I would think to someone without the deepest knowledge of silent films, perhaps the first people who would come up are the silent comedic actors like Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton. I was wondering if comedy and drama are equally represented, or if you tend to see more one or the other.
We do a statistical analysis of the films that we receive each year. The way a filmmaker competes in this competition is they go to the website, makesilentfilm.com. They listen to the six different musical scores that have been composed for the festival. The rules are you must use one of those six scores. The musical scores have different themes. There's romance, there's action, there's horror, there's science fiction, along those genres. So the filmmakers will tend to make films reflective of the mood and the tempo of the musical competition. We see an even distribution amongst all six themes. Now, in terms of making a silent movie, the challenge to the filmmaker is to reinterpret silent film in any way they wish. We do have a lot of historical references in the films that the kids submit, but we also have some brand new interpretations that take visual storytelling to a whole different level using technology in the film that's current today, and it's just exciting. So this platform is wide open. There are no rules. It can be animation, it can be live action, it can be color, it can be black and white. The only thing that we ask is, A, you don't modify the musical scores, B, it's family friendly, and C, that you're not using any copyrighted material.
Would you say that working with silent film expands these filmmakers' understanding of film in general in a way maybe beyond just historical understanding in terms of developing film production skills in a unique way?
I think that's a great outcome of this process. I mean, if you think about what's happening with the filmmaker, it's a big undertaking. You're talking about developing a story where you care about the characters and what's happening to them. Then you've got to put your team together. There's rehearsal for the acting components, there's the filming elements, and then you actually edit down your film. Now, the nice thing about this particular genre is we don't have to worry about sound editing, and so it makes it a little more accessible. But that means you really need to focus on your story, because you're telling your story with visual storytelling as opposed to the characters telling you what's happening. So we see probably a tremendous amount of learning going on. And quite frankly, there are school teachers out there that learn about this festival. They're making it part of their curriculum, and we see the same schools coming back year after year.
I was going to ask about that, if you had considered expanding it in an educational capacity.
Jen, that's something we're completely open to. We actually posted an outline of a curriculum on the website at makesilentfilm.com that is available for teachers to download and use for free. It was developed by teachers for teachers. We have as our mission with this nonprofit, and again, the International Youth Silent Film Festival is a nonprofit organization. One of our missions is providing outreach, support, and education to students and the support of educators in providing this opportunity to them.
Terrific. Before we wrap up, I'd just like to ask, could you give the basic info about the event coming up later this May?
We will be screening at the Hollywood Theater May 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. The event starts at 7 o'clock, and tickets can be purchased on our website or at the Hollywood Theater's website. And then the actual award ceremony is delayed until June 6th. It's an official Rose Festival event as part of the Creative Youth Awards, and that's also at the Hollywood Theater, 7 p.m., June 6th.
Well, there you have it, the International Youth Silent Film Festival. And JP did mention you can find out more at the festival's website, makesilentfilm.com. I've been speaking with John Palinuk, the founder of the festival. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks,
JP.
Jen. We appreciate your interest.
Now back to Conch for more of the film show on KBOO Community Radio.
Yes, thanks, Jen. This is the film show on KBOO, and I think that you actually have a couple tickets to give away to the Youth Silent Film Festival. Is that right?
Yes, it is. I just wanted to announce that we're giving away one pair of tickets to the opening night of the International Youth Silent Film Festival, which takes place May 21st, 7 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater. We'll call tickets. We'll go to the third caller to our studios. The number is 503-231-8032. Again, that's 503-231-8032. Best of luck.
Yes, indeed. And while you're dialing away, we have a guest live in the studio here who is bringing his film, his feature-length film, to the QDoc, Portland Queer Documentary Film Festival, which is coming up starting on the 16th. And we'd like to welcome very much Eric Slade.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Eric, so tell us about Big Joy. This is a documentary about somebody who I've just heard of on the fringes of various scenes, but he's been on some of the just biggest movements in post-war America, some of the San Francisco culture that was happening post-war, the beat poetry scene, Eastern philosophy, experimental film. Tell us about the subject of your film, James Broughton.
Well, James Broughton was an amazing poet and filmmaker, and he's a playwright. I'm part of the Radical Fairy movement, so I first met James way back in the early 80s at a radical fairy gathering, I think at Wolf Creek, Oregon. But he became kind of a mentor and a sort of a spokesperson for queer liberation in those days. But way back in the 40s in San Francisco, he was part of something called the San Francisco Renaissance, which was the movement that gave birth to the Beats. So Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti and Kerouac and all those guys kind of came in and invaded San Francisco and built on this movement that James Broughton and all his friends had actually already built.
Yeah, James Broughton was already there in the 40s. And then these folks from New York came in. And joined up.
As Ferlinghetti says in the film, I'm just a carpetbagger. I got here in 51.
Well, you know, I have to say, as a straight guy watching this film with my girlfriend, I never felt left out. This is not a film that belongs in the gay ghetto. It's not a film that belongs in the documentary ghetto. It's about a guy who was very playful, very joyful, and the film gets across that sense. I would characterize this film as being Ken Burns meets Terry Gilliam.
I love that. Yeah, I mean, when we started making the film, we always said what we wanted it to be was actually sort of an experiential prayer that you live through, you know, an experience that you came out different. And what we found from the audiences who've watched the film is that they come out saying, yes, I want to live a life more like that. I want to live a bigger life. I want to live a more artistic life. One of James's mottos was follow your own weird. And what he meant by weird is not just like act strange, but he meant find that thing inside yourself that's true for you and then live from that place. And he spent his whole life, you know, trying to do that. And as you see in the film, it wasn't easy. There's like lots of collateral damage along the way. But I think he found his big joy.
Well, and that brings up a good point. It's like looking, especially when Alan Watts was one of the people that he hung out with in an early time, talking about Eastern philosophy, but also talking about, you know, the Western tradition as well. Joy shouldn't be confused with happiness, because James Broughton was not always a happy guy. You know, he was, you know, often a very depressed child. He was obsessed with death, especially in his younger poet days. But that joy, it's to him, it's like a different thing. It's beyond emotion. It's like a state of grace.
Yeah, that's right. I think so. And I think it's, you know, for him, it was about finding that kind of inner part of himself that he wanted to live his life from. And he spent his whole life doing that, you know. And I think there's a lot of difficulty that he encounters along the way. And, you know, like you said, he was suicidal. At some point he says, film helped me, saved me from suicide. So one of the things I loved was that his lover, Joel Singer, when we interviewed him, he said that whenever Joel was depressed, James would just look at him and say, oh, just go make some art, it's like inspiration to me. It's like, you know, it's like you don't have to be happy to make art. In fact, it can be a great inspiration to live your life from an artistic place, no matter what your state of mind is at this point. So
that is good advice for anybody, not just artists.
It's true.
Make some art. Well, yeah, speaking of which, again, James Broughton was part of all these scenes with incredible people around him. George Kuchar was, I believe, a student of his. Poets such as Muriel Rukeyser, dancers, Anna Halperin, there's Imogene Cunningham, Stan Brakhage, the great breakthrough filmmaker. What I was fascinated by, Stan Brakhage, this is back in the early 60s, and I wouldn't expect this of him, pushed this poor gay guy to get married to a woman, and so did his Jungian analyst.
Yeah, I know, it was a big drag. James had lovers early in his life, lovers.
Well, he also was lovers with Pauline Kael. This was one of the really amazing things to me.
Yeah, they actually had a child together, and we tried to get an interview with Gina James, their offspring, but she was not interested in taking part in the film. But you know, he had. Male lovers during the early part of his life, but then at some point his analyst and Stan Brakhage pushed him to get married, and he found a partner who he thought would make a great partner for him, and they were married for many years, had kids, but in the end, you know, he goes a different way.
And there's an incredible trove of people that you managed to get into the movie. You did get his son and his wife to talk to the camera, but also there's an incredible amount of archival footage, and you also mess with it in playful ways, which I like. You take all of this black and white footage and you sort of take a sort of 50s, 60s experimental style of bringing out effects that sort of old school psychedelic effects into it.
Yeah, I mean, we knew we weren't going to make an experimental film. I mean, James made amazing experimental films, so we knew that wasn't our task. But we also knew that we needed to make a film that was inspired by his work. And he wrote a great book called Making Light of It, which is his kind of a film school book, how to make a film. But it includes things like never make a film like anybody else made, because you'll just bore yourself and you'll bore your audience. So he set the bar really high. And so we were, you know, scared all the way through the process of making this film, because we wanted to make sure it lived up to his standards. And I think he'd be happy, because I think we did find a narrative structure and we found a story that works for it. But we also kind of jumped the rails at times and go off the tracks here and there.
Yeah, there is a lot of there's some beautiful transitions. You have a lot of B-roll, as they say, you know, a lot of imagery that sort of picks up and reflects the story, as well as all this great historical footage, all the photographs. And you had full access to James Broughton's film library, for example, from his lover who survived him.
Right, his lover Joel is a big backer of our project, and just gave us he has the rights to everything, and gave us rights to his 23 films, his 23 books of poetry. So there's a lot of archive in there. You know, one of my favorite things about James's work is that his playful use of nudity. So there's a lot of nudity in the film, and we actually met with the folks from PBS at a film market recently, and they said, "Well, yeah, we're really interested in your film because we love the story of artists." And I'm like, "You know, there's a lot of nudity. There's a lot of penises in this film." But, you know, and I think they actually eventually passed on it because of that. But as Pauline Kael says at one point, you know, James's work was anything but pornographic. It's all playful, and all of the sex in the film, I mean, there's no actual sex, but all the sexual imagery is really playful and honoring of the human body. So he made a film in 1967 called The Bed, which is...
Yes, this is a great little irony, speaking of pornography. This was actually the movie that got you interested in his work.
Right, yeah, and that's the film I first saw, the first piece of work that I ever saw of James, and it totally inspired me. I think it inspired me in my filmmaking all the way up until now.
Sort of made in the summer of love in San Francisco, and it's the adventures of this bed that goes up and down hills, and then
right,
people start interacting with it.
Exactly. So it starts with a bed that rolls down a hillside in the Marin countryside. It rolls down, spins around once, and suddenly it's populated by like kind of a who's who of the artists of that era in the Bay Area. There's Imogen Cunningham, there's Alan Watts, all these different people, and they're almost all naked. And this was a groundbreaking at the time. This is full frontal nudity in an experimental art film, and it's really beautiful. But the thing is, he couldn't get this film printed. He couldn't find any lab to print it, because no one would print a naked film. So he had to take it to a pornography lab in the middle of the night, and they agreed they'd print it overnight. Now, and then a year later, 2 years later, this kind of thing became easy. His next film featured even more nudity, but he had no problem printing it. I think everything changed in America, and I'm not sure you can totally say it was because of his film, but his film was part of the ground shift.
Yeah,
happened.
I think it was only the next year or two that the MPAA came out with the rating system, and you started seeing and The Bed became this huge breakout film. We have to say people from the counterculture were just going in droves to see it.
It was a cult hit, and still actually is shown today. In fact, somebody was telling me that they show it to nursing students to get them more comfortable with the human body.
Interesting. This reminds me of when my mom, who is a retired minister, was in clinical pastoral education, and they would show actually pornographic movies to these students in seminary to get them accustomed to just about anything.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. So let's talk about how you – I would be neglectful if I didn't mention your co-director, Stephen Silha, who was a big reason why you got all the access and you were able to make this film.
Yeah, Stephen is the impetus for this film. He was good friends with James, actually, in the last 10 years of his life. And Stephen came to me about 4 years ago and said, "I want to make this film about James." He's a journalist. He'd never made a film before, but he'd seen a film that I had done earlier called Hope Along the Wind, about the life of Harry Hay, one of the premier gay activists in the U.S. And he liked the film, and he said, "Let's work together." And Stephen and I knew each other from fairy gatherings and from radical fairy culture, and so yeah, we embarked on this journey together, and it was a good partnership. He's an amazing person, Stephen, and he kept pushing us. He didn't really he never done a film before. So he kept saying, let's try this and let's try this. And I kept saying, you know, let's stick to the story, stick to the story, stick to the story. But it was a good partnership because we pushed each other in different ways.
Well, Eric Slade, magician, professional magician.
That's
you've
right.
been Burning Man. I think I've seen your act there. You have worked on History Detectives, the OPB series.
It's a national PBS series of History Detectives. That's
and,
right.
And now, filmmaker, are you going to be in attendance at the QDoc?
I will.
To screen your film.
Steven and I will both be there. It's Saturday, May 18th at 7 p.m. QDoc starts out at the Baghdad Theater on Thursday, but then moves over to the Kennedy School for the rest of the run. So it's that through that whole weekend.
It's the 16th through the 19th. And the opening night is a documentary about Divine.
Exactly.
The star of many underground films of the 70s.
Right. I think she calls herself the filthiest person in the world.
Well, Eric Slade, again, the QDoc Festival is coming up. You can check, I think, the McMiniman's website. Or is there a website for the QDoc?
Yeah, just itself? Go to just Google QDoc. You'll find it. QDoc 2013. It's an amazing festival. And I should say it's like the only queer documentary film festival in the country and only one of two in the world. So we're really lucky to have that here in Portland.
Well, Eric Slade, thanks again. We'll look forward to seeing you at the Kennedy School on the 18th of May. And you're listening to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Concer. I'm here with Jen Chavez, who has a lot more information about events coming up in the next few weeks.
Absolutely. I have quite a few interesting film events coming up over the end of this month and next. On April 25th today and 26th tomorrow at the Northwest Film Center, you can catch the best of the 39th Northwest Filmmakers Festival. This touring program of festival highlights kicks off at 7 p.m. To learn more, go to nwfilm.org. On May 1st, at 6 p.m., the Northwest Film Center hosts its Project Viewfinder screening, premiering material made by teens transitioning out of homelessness under the Film Center's mentorship. We featured folks with this program on our show last month, which can be found on KBOO's website, kboo.fm. For more information on their program and the upcoming screening, visit nwfilm.org. And on the following day, May 2nd, the Film Center presents the 7 p.m. premiere of Everything Went Down as part of their Northwest Tracking Series. It's a contemporary musical by local filmmaker and PSU professor Dustin Morrow, who will be in attendance for a post-film Q&A. The website, again, nwfilm.org. On March 3rd through 5th, the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival and Cthulhu-thon returns for the 18th time to the Hollywood Theater to promote the work of H.P. Lovecraft, literary horror, and weird tales through professional and amateur cinematic adaptations. Screenings at 7 on Friday and 1 on Saturday and Sunday. Visit hplfilmfestival.com to learn more. At the Clinton Street Theater on March 7th, catch the PNCA Video Fest 2013 at 7 p.m., an annual juried festival of moving image works by students of the Pacific Northwest College of Arts. For more info, go to cstpdx.com. Two screenings by the local Cinema Project Collective coming up this month. On May 7th and 8th at 7:30 p.m., they'll show Picture in Picture, Japanese experimental films of the late 70s and 80s, with a different program each night. On May 23rd at 7 p.m., they'll screen Weird Worlds, Experiments in Animation, in collaboration with the Experimental Film Festival. Both screenings are at Yale Union in Southeast Portland. See cinemaproject.org to learn more. On May 9th, the Clinton Street Theater's collaborative screening series KBOO at the Clinton continues at 7 with The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman, made as a critique of the education documentary Waiting for Superman and offering a fresh perspective on education reform. Go to cstpdx.com for more. The first annual Portland Ego Film Festival continues at the Hollywood with a screening of the new documentary Fruit Hunters at 7:30 p.m., followed by a panel discussion. To learn more, go to hollywoodtheater.org/egofilm. From May 17th through 19th, the Portland Animation Festival graces the Hollywood Theater, featuring 151 animated films from 30 countries, including after parties and filmmakers in attendance. Screenings at 7 on Friday, 1 on Saturday and Sunday. Go to nw animationfest.com for more info. The second annual Experimental Film Festival takes place from May 20th through the 27th, showcasing experimental media at venues scattered across the city. For details, visit EFFPortland.com. A reminder about the Youth Silent Film Festival, May 21st through 23rd at the Hollywood Theater. We just wanted to mention tickets are $10 for adults and $5 for students. That website again is makesilentfilm.com. On the 27th, a touring program of archival footage from Mississippi Records called I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore is making a stop at the Hollywood Theater. And on May 30th, the Hollywood will house the 2013 Portland Music Video Festival. Go to hollywoodtheater.org for more information on both. That about wraps it up. And back to you, Conch.
Thanks, Jen. This is SW Concert with the Film Show. And I'd like to let all of our listeners know that there will be an extended version of Jen's interview with John Palahniuk of the Youth Silent Film Festival. That will be available later today on our website, kboo.fm/thefilmshow.
Thank you very much to all of our listeners today, and thanks to the Oregon Media Production Association for their ongoing support and collaboration. And now, stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown radio station in Portland, KBOO.
Yes, you are listening to KBOO Portland. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how we can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery. Committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at our carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Shocks of Sheba has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Welcome to Shocks of Sheba.